Welcome, good people who like to listen to things that I send out randomly. I'm talking today about equanimity because I don't have enough of it, and I'm trying to learn how to be more balanced and more protected in my life, protected from, as you'll learn as I talk about this, from this article in Tricycle, which is a Buddhist magazine, the Buddhist Review, called Tricycle. As I talk about that, it'll make sense what you're trying to protect yourself from with this practice of equanimity. All right, here I go. Equanimity, one of the most sublime emotions of Buddhist practice, is the ground for wisdom and freedom and the protector of compassion and love. While some may think of equanimity as dry neutrality or cool aloofness, mature equanimity produces a radiance and warmth of being. The Buddha described a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. The English word equanimity translates two separate Pali words used by the Buddha, upekkha and tatramajahata. Tatramajahata. I think I got it there. Upekkha, the more common term, means to look over, and refers to the equanimity that arises from the power of observation, the ability to see without being caught by what we see. When well developed, such power gives rise to a great sense of peace. Upekkha can also refer to the spaciousness that comes from seeing a bigger picture. Colloquially, in India, the word was sometimes used to mean to see with patience. We might understand this as seeing with understanding. For example, when we know not to take offensive words personally, we are less likely to react to what was said. And by not reacting, there is greater possibility to respond from wisdom and compassion. This form of equanimity is sometimes compared to grandmotherly love. The grandmother clearly loves her grandchildren, but, thanks to her experience with her own children, is less likely to be caught up in the drama of the grandchildren's lives. Still more qualities of equanimity are revealed by the term tatramajahata. Tatramajahata, a long compound made of simple Pali words. Tatra, meaning there, sometimes refers to all these things. Maja means middle, and tata means to stand or to pose. Put together, the word becomes to stand in the middle of all this. As a form of equanimity, this being in the middle refers to balance, to remaining centered in the middle of whatever is happening. This form of balance comes from some inner strength or stability. The strong presence of inner calm, well-being, confidence, vitality, or integrity can keep us upright, like ballast keeps a ship upright in strong winds. As inner strength develops, for example, from the accumulation of mindfulness in the ordinary moments of life, equanimity follows. Equanimity is a protection from what are called the eight worldly winds, praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. Becoming attached to or excessively elated with success, praise, fame, or pleasure can be a setup for suffering when the winds of change shift. For example, success can be wonderful, but if it leads to arrogance, we have more to lose in future challenges. Becoming personally invested in praise can tend toward conceit. Identifying with failure, we may feel incompetent or inadequate. Reacting to pain, we may become discouraged. If we understand or feel that our sense of inner well-being is independent of the eight winds, we are more likely to remain on an even keel in their midst. A simple definition of equanimity, considering the various Pali roots, is the capacity to not be caught up with what happens to us. We can practice with equanimity by studying the ways that we get caught. Instead of pursuing the ideal of balance and non-reactivity directly, we can give careful attention to how balance is lost and how reactivity is triggered. Trying to fit into some idealistic model of what being equanimous is supposed to look like can all too easily produce such threats to equanimity as indifference, aloofness, rigidity, or complacency. But when the obstacles are understood and removed, then the resulting equanimity can be the foundation for caring, presence, flexibility, and diligence. That's from Gil Fronsdal. And Gil Fronsdal teaches at the Insight Meditation Center and at Spirit Rock Meditation Center. He's practiced extensively in the Soto Zen and Theravada Buddhist traditions. He's the author of The Issue at Hand, Essays on Buddhist Mindfulness Practice. Okay, a little more on equanimity after Gil's writing. Upandita on Developing Equanimity. According to the Buddha, the way to bring about equanimity is wise attention. To be continually mindful from moment to moment without a break, based on the intention to develop equanimity. One moment of equanimity causes a succeeding moment of equanimity to arise. Once equanimity is activated, it will be the cause for equanimity to continue and to deepen. It can bring one to deep levels of practice beyond the insight into the arising and passing away of phenomena. Equanimity does not arise easily in the minds of beginning yogis, though these yogis may be diligent in trying to be mindful from moment to moment. Equanimity comes and goes. The mind will be well balanced for a little while, and then it will go off again. Step by step, equanimity is strengthened. The intervals when it is present grow more prolonged and frequent. Eventually, equanimity becomes strong enough to qualify as a factor of enlightenment. Along with this practice of wise attention, here are five more ways to develop equanimity. Number one, balanced emotion toward all living things. First and foremost is to have an equanimous attitude toward all living beings. These are your loved ones, including animals. We have a lot of attachment and desire associated with people we love and also with our pets. Sometimes we can be what we call crazy about someone. This experience does not contribute to equanimity, which is a state of balance. To prepare the ground for equanimity to arise, one should try to cultivate an attitude of non-attachment and equanimity toward the people and animals we love. As worldly people, it may be necessary to have a certain amount of attachment in relationships, but excessive attachment is destructive to us, as well as to loved ones. We begin to worry too much about their welfare. One reflection that can develop non-attachment is to regard all beings as the heirs of their own karma. People reap the rewards of good karma and suffer the consequences of unwholesome acts. They created this karma under their own volition, and no one can prevent their experiencing the consequences. On the ultimate level, there is nothing you or anybody else can do to save them. If you think in this way, you may worry less about your loved ones. When I reflect on that, I have a lot of issues connected to that attitude of non-attachment, in part because of my feelings of abandonment and feelings of deficits of attachment around my dad and intensity of attachment around my mom. Neither of the attachments to my mom or dad were consistent, unconditional, or balanced. They were wanting, they were needing, they were disappointing, they were smothering. I know both of my parents loved me, and I also know that what I felt was a lot of pain and a lot of unbalanced love. So non-attachment toward people I meet and try to connect to is really hard for me. Might say impossible. But I agree with this notion that worrying too much about other people hurts you, hurts yourself. Concern for their welfare, reaching out to be in touch and be connected is very important to me, but worrying too much about other people in their lives is a problem I have and have had. So I value this idea of trying to find more balance in motion. In this same heading of balanced emotion toward all living things, you can also gain equanimity about beings by reflecting on ultimate reality. Perhaps you can tell yourself that ultimately speaking, there is only mind and matter. Where is that person you are so wildly in love with? There is only nama and rupa, mind and body, arising and passing away from moment to moment. Which moment are you in love with? You may be able to drive some sense into your heart this way. One might worry that reflections like this could turn into unfeeling indifference and lead us to abandon a mate or a dear person. This is not the case. Equanimity is not insensitivity or indifference or apathy. It is simply non-preferential. Under its influence, one does not push aside the things one dislikes or grasp at the things one prefers. The mind rests in an attitude of balance and acceptance of things as they are. When equanimity, this factor of enlightenment, is present, one abandons both attachment to beings and dislike for them. The texts tell us that equanimity is the cause for the cleansing and purification of one who has deep tendencies toward lust or desire, which is the opposite of equanimity. Number two is balanced emotion toward inanimate things. Second way of developing this factor of enlightenment is to adopt an attitude of balance toward inanimate things, property, clothing, the latest fad on the market. Clothing, for example, will be ripped and stained someday. It will decay and perish because it is impermanent like everything else. Furthermore, we do not even own it, not in the ultimate sense. Everything is non-self. There is no one to own anything. To develop balance and to cut down attachment, it is helpful to look at material things as transient. You might say to yourself, I'm going to make use of this for a short time. It's not going to last forever. People who get caught up in fads may be compelled to buy each new product that appears on the market. Once this gadget has been bought, another more sophisticated model soon appears. Such persons throw away the old one, buy a new one. This behavior does not reflect equanimity. I don't feel like I have to work toward being more balanced in my emotion toward inanimate things, toward objects. Maybe I need to be more balanced about how I feel when I start to open my email on my phone. Maybe I can take a breath and be mindful that the person who I'm seeing an email from is in fact a person and not just an annoying set of letters that is telling me I need to do something or giving me some sort of task or some sort of necessary response. That feeling about emotion toward email is, it's an inanimate thing, right? But it is language, it is text-based, it is a person's words behind it. So maybe thinking of the phone as completely neutral is what I could focus on here. And taking a moment to set the intention before I open the email that whatever I read in the email is not going to affect the internal sense of balance. That would be hard to do. I'll try to do that. Number three, avoiding people who, quote, go crazy. The third method for developing equanimity as an enlightenment factor is avoiding the company of people who tend to be crazy about people and things. These people have a deep possessiveness. They cling to what they think belongs to them, both people and things. Some people find it difficult to see another person enjoying or using their property. There is a case of an elder who had a great attachment to pets. It seems that in his monastery he bred a lot of cats and dogs. One day this elder came to my center in Rangoon to do a retreat. When he was meditating, he was practicing under favorable circumstances, but his practice was not very deep. Finally, I had an idea and asked him if he had any pets in his monastery. He brightened up and said, "Oh yes, I have so many dogs and cats. Ever since I came here, I've been thinking about whether they have enough food to eat and how they're doing." I asked him to forget about the animals and concentrate on meditation, and quite soon he was making good progress. I'm not sure I enjoy telling people not to love their pets when pets serve as a necessary source of love and connection for people who really need it. At the same time, I do see how love that is uncontained and kind of chemical oxytocin is released in your body when you're bonding with your animal. That oxytocin is what makes people go a little crazy and feel hearts coming out of the eyes. And that feeling does go away from balance, I think. So, yeah, I understand the idea behind this. To focus yourself means to let go of all of the people who tend to go away from themselves, whether it's toward objects or towards deep attachment to other people at the expense of their sense of self. So kind of go toward the balanced people and try to go away from the unbalanced people who are not attempting to find balance, at least. And this is tricky because our culture is good at telling us to go away from toxic people and find only calm, positive people to stick with. But the positive thing is to find people who are also, like you, searching for balance. And that searching for balance can come through suffering and through exploring and reflecting on pain, rather than ignoring it. So there's definitely value in staying with people who are searching versus staying with people who are on autopilot. Number 4 is kind of the same idea, choosing friends who stay cool. Again, I don't think that's always the best idea. Number 5, inclining the mind toward balance. The 5th and last cause for this factor of enlightenment is to constantly incline your mind toward the cultivation of equanimity. When your mind is inclined in this way, it will not wander off to thoughts of animals or loved ones. It will only become more balanced and harmonious. Equanimity is of tremendous importance both in the practice and in everyday life. Generally, we get either swept away by pleasant or enticing objects or worked up into a great state of agitation when confronted by unpleasant or undesirable objects. This wild alternation of contraries is nearly universal among human beings. When we lack the ability to stay balanced and unfaltering, we are easily swept into extremes of craving or aversion. When the mind indulges in sensual objects, it becomes agitated. This is the usual state of affairs in the world, as we can observe. In their quest for happiness, people mistake excitement of the mind for real happiness. They never have the chance to experience greater joy that comes with peace and tranquility. 7 Supports for Equanimity from Gil Fronsdahl. Integrity. When we live and act with integrity or virtue, we feel confident about our actions and words, which results in the equanimity of blamelessness. The ancient Buddhist texts speak of being able to go into any assembly of people and feel blameless. While any kind of faith can provide equanimity, faith grounded in wisdom is especially powerful. The Pali word for faith, sada, is also translated as conviction or confidence. If we have confidence, for example, in our ability to engage in a spiritual practice, then we are more likely to meet its challenges with equanimity. A well-developed mind, number 3. Much as we might develop physical strength, balance, and stability of the body in a gym, so too can we develop strength, balance, and stability of the mind. This is done through practices that cultivate calm, concentration, and mindfulness. When the mind is calm, we are less likely to be blown about by the worldly winds. Well-being, number 4. In Buddhism, it's considered appropriate and helpful to cultivate and enhance our well-being. It is all too easy to overlook the well-being that is easily available in daily life. Even taking time to enjoy one's tea or the sunset can be a training in letting in well-being. I fully agree with this. Slow down. be present in whatever you're doing, whether it's cleaning, raking leaves, walking, sipping coffee or tea, or just waking up. Number 5, wisdom. Wisdom can teach us to separate people's actions from who they are. We can agree or disagree with their actions, but remain balanced in our relationship with a person. Or we can understand that our own thoughts and impulses are the result of impersonal conditions. By not taking them so personally, we are more likely to stay at ease with their arising. One of the most powerful ways to use wisdom to facilitate equanimity is to be mindful of when equanimity is absent. Honest awareness of what makes us imbalanced helps us to learn how to find balance. Wisdom can also be an important factor in learning to have an accepting awareness, to be present without the mind or heart contracting or resisting. 6. Insight. Insight is a deep seeing into the nature of things as they are. One of the primary insights is the nature of impermanence. In the deepest forms of insight, we see that things change so quickly that we can't hold on to anything, and eventually the mind lets go of clinging. Letting go brings equanimity. The greater the letting go, the deeper the equanimity. Number 7, the last one, freedom. Freedom comes when we begin to let go of our reactive tendencies. We can get a taste of what this means by noticing areas in which we were once reactive but are no longer so. For example, some issues that upset us when we were teenagers prompt no reaction at all when we are adults. In Buddhist practice, we work to expand the range of life experiences in which we are free. Amen to that. The reactivity that is so easy to indulge in has gotten a little bit harder to indulge in with more calmness and more breathing, and with life moving on past depressive stages that I've been through. Having the time to do something like this, read an article on equanimity in order to gain a deeper understanding of it and reflect on what are challenges for me around it, is a way for me to practice expanding that range to find freedom, taking 30 minutes, not just to read something, but to hear myself say this and reflect on my life with it, allows me to go deeper than dip my toe into it, maybe. Maybe I'm up to my waist in the water of equanimity. Thanks for listening. I'm going to end with the Tibetan singing bowl for a few minutes.